Now, there's a Jewish saying, a rabbi or a disciple does five things. He learns the text, he lives the text, he teaches the text, he prays the text, and he dies the text. Let's look at that in light of Jesus. Since we want to be like Jesus as his disciples, let's look at how Jesus stacks up against learn the text, live the text, pray the text, die the text. I'm sorry. Learn the text, live the text, teach the text, pray the text, die the text. Okay? First of all, I'll do this real quickly. I think I can argue Jesus learned the text. Notice, when he was a boy, he was in the temple, listening to the scholars and asking them questions. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding. Notice he's using the rabbinic system of question. Second, and you recited this morning, Jesus said, "Everything I learned, I taught you." Clearly, he himself says, "I learned the text." So let's leave it at that. Now, did Jesus live the text? And that one I love to jump into because there's this Christian view somehow that because Jesus was God, the Old Testament was now finished, the New Testament was now come, Jesus didn't have to keep the Old Testament anymore. I don't see that at all. I see exactly the opposite. I see a passionate desire on his part to keep every single letter of his Bible. Let's look at a couple of examples, or at least one. We'll see what time allows. Okay, so come with me. In the Hebrew Bible, God gave a commandment about clothing. Now, you should know, in biblical times, people wore two pieces of clothing. They wore an underrobe called haluk. Say haluk. Say haluk. Say haluk like you mean it. Yes. Now, a haluk looked like a t-shirt without sleeves but sewn shut, so it was modest, that came down just below the knee. It was appropriate to be seen by family, even outdoors, in haluk, but not in public. Over top of it, you wore a robe called talit. Say talit. Say talit. Now, the rich could afford a talit without a seam, so you pulled it on like a shirt. It was much easier, much tighter, much more comfortable. The poor had one with a seam that closed like a bathrobe, and they had to wear a belt on it. How Jesus got the rich man's robe is anybody's guess, but he seems to have had one. Now, those were the two basic garments. In public, that talit, which had sleeves and came down just above the ankle, that was the garment you wore in public. You could wear a cloak over top of it if it was cold, but typically you wore those two. They did not wear underwear, typically, except menstrual. And that's supported, by the way, in the Bible, God said the priests have to wear underwear lest they be exposed on the altar when they climb up. And that would support the idea that if everybody wore underwear, why would you have to make such a commandment? So, now, why did I tell you such a bizarre thing? I want to convince you. All my life, I grew up thinking of Jesus as my Messiah, although I wasn't saved till I was 25. I still thought of him as that. And the Son of God, the Savior of the world. But he wasn't somebody that I thought I'd walk halfway across the world to sit and listen to him teach. Now, maybe you did, but I didn't. And then I saw him in the Jewish world. This guy had an unbelievably clever sense of humor. He had a delightful way of grabbing people by the shirt and shaking them. He was just an amazing communicator. So he says, if somebody comes up to you and asks for your talit, give him your haluk too. Now think about that for a moment. That's all you got on. And everybody laughed. It was like, oh, that's stupid. You take your talit and your haluk on. And his point is, better you be naked than somebody else be cold. But he says it in a way that has such a clever, humorous twist to it that you'd never forget it. Anyway, God said, I want you to sew tassels. Say tzit tzit. Say tzit tzit. Tzit tzit. That's actually tassel. Tassels is tzitziot, but we'll leave it singular. On the corner, say kanaf. 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 Of your talit. So, sew tzitziot on the kanfot of your talitot. Sew tassels on the corners of your robes. Now, today, Jews wear something, religious Jews, wear something that looks like this. Sometimes you'll see a picture of Jesus with this, but Jesus didn't wear this. This is to remind them of their ancient robe. They didn't wear, but so they call it talit. Same name as their ancient robe. Now notice, on the four corners, tassels. Even God has a sense of humor. I see God sitting in heaven saying, hey angels, watch this. Moses, tell the Israelites to sew tassels on the corners of their round robe. And he doesn't tell them what the corners are. It's so funny. They have spent 3,500 years arguing about what's the corner of a round robe. And it's like God says, you figure it out. And what you decide is good for me. You know what the rabbis call that? God said, what's bound on earth is bound in heaven. What's loosed on earth is loosed in heaven. What you decide is okay with me. So he leaves it up to them. So they today wear something like this to remind them of those tassels. Now they were on the corner of the robe. Why? Well, God does tell them why. He doesn't tell them what corners are, but he tells them why. God says, whenever you look at these tassels, you will remember all that I commanded you and obey every command. So this is their living visual aid. Now think about this for a moment. Every single outer piece of clothing you wore had to have these four strings. How many times did you step on them? Dirty them? Did they come unbound and slip out? This was a constant harassment. You thought high heels were nasty accessories. Think of what this would be constantly. But God said, every time you see it, it'll nudge you. Obey me. Obey me, obey me, and don't you forget it. Everything you wear, sew tassels. Now, the Jews, of course, immediately take their command and they begin to interpret because God wants them to complete it, they believe. So they said, kanaf, say kanaf. Means corner, yes? It also means wing. Same word. So there's a corner right there. Kanaf. There's a corner over there. Well, it's kind of a... There's a corner over there. Kanaf. But a bird has two kanafs. Shtaim, you say, kanfot. Two wings. So this means corner and wing. So they taught when the priests say the blessing, they would raise their hands to bless. Because that illustrated to you, you are under God's wings. And when they raised their hands to bless, guess what dangled prominently? The tassels. They're on the wings. So they said, God is teaching us, if you obey God, He will cover you with His wings. Now, I don't know if that's what God had in mind, but I certainly would argue that both of those things are true. Obey God, He will cover you. Amen? Okay, remember that. Now come with me. So Jews wore tassels. Come with me into the desert. Judah desert this time, where Jesus was tempted. Let's hike up this canyon. Gets a little wider when you get in a little farther. And we're tired. So let's make our way into this cave. In this cave, we discover a bunch of young, tough guys. I mean, these are bad-looking guys. Tough, hard-nosed guys, heavily armed. Coming up the canyon is an army. And in front of those special forces is their commander, who's about a foot taller than everybody else. And he stops the column and he says, "Wait here." Heads up the hill into the cave to use the men's room. Please don't teach your class that Saul went to the cave to rest. The Hebrew clearly is much more earthy than that. Saul had to meet a man about a dog, or whatever you say in this part of the country. Now, he gets into the cave, and David's guys say to him, "You got him. You got him. Get him. God gave him to you. Kill him." David's like, "I can't do that. That's God's anointed." So he crawls up to where Saul has discarded his tallit, and he cuts off the corner. Now you got to understand, he's talking. It wasn't just, "Let's see, shall I take the belt loop? Shall I take the pocket? Shall I take a..." He wants this tassel because he wants to say something. Snip. Saul gets finished, comes back, pulls the tallit on, doesn't notice the tassel, of course, and away he goes. Gets across the canyon, and David says, "Shaul! Shaul!" What is David saying? What does this tassel say? Obey. Thank you. "You haven't obeyed God, Saul. So he won't protect you. I took the symbol of obedience, and I took the symbol of God's wings." Now, David's reaction when he does that, he's mortified. He says, "Who am I to do that?" Now, I'm not sure why, but I suspect he's thinking, "I can't decide who obeys God. I can't decide who God will protect. That's not my business." But notice in the passage, Saul catches it. Because Saul says, "Now I know that the Lord will no longer protect me." What do you mean, Saul? He just saved your life. David could have killed you. No, Saul knows his protection is gone. Isn't that cool? Come with me. It's Pentecost. They're collecting the wheat. They're going to put it on the threshing floor and then ride around it on a threshing sled to separate the grain from the husk, and then wait for a windy day and throw the whole mess up in the air. And of course, the wind will blow the chaff away and the grain will be brought back into the barns. Am I right? Now, there's a field. There's a young woman who's gleaning. She's picking up what's been dropped, and she's picking up what the harvesters have left standing in the corner. She comes home at night with this enormous, I suppose, robe filled with grain. And her mother-in-law says, "Ruth, where did you get this? Look! Oi! I can't believe it!" And Ruth says, "Well, I was in the field of this guy. His name was, his name was Boaz. Boaz! 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 Boaz of Bethlehem? Yeah! Boaz of Bethlehem? Yeah! Boaz of Bethlehem is our relative. The Torah says he has to marry you. Go tell him." Because the Torah says if a woman's husband die and she has no children, his nearest male relative must take her, marry her, and help her to have a child to continue the family. So Ruth heads down to the threshing floor. Boaz is sleeping across the entrance, keeping two-legged and four-legged thieves away from his harvest. So she comes up, sees him sound asleep there. He's also been partying a bit, according to the book. What does she do? Your Bible says she uncovers his feet. That's accurate. But that's a colloquial expression, which means she exposed his genitals. Sorry. She did. At least that's what she's hinting at. If you say, well, it doesn't say that. Uncover one's feet is the phrase used for use the bathroom. Look it up. It's in the Old Testament several times. Now, why would Ruth hint at, or I think literally, why would she expose him? Well, tell me about Boaz. Who's Boaz? The obvious stuff. Who's Boaz? Pardon? A rich, rich what? Rich relative. Tell me about a rich relative named Boaz. Kinsman redeemer. Ah, you people are so deep. I want even more surface stuff. Tell me about Boaz, the obvious. Farmer, a man. What kind of a man? No, he's probably married. What kind of a man? He's Jewish. Tell me about a Jewish man. He's circumcised. She wants him to think about his circumcision. Because his circumcision is a symbol of his covenant with God in which he is committed to obeying God. If he is in covenant, the covenant demands that he marry her. If you don't think that's true, look up the passage where Abraham sends his old servant to find a wife for Isaac, and he says, put your hand under my thigh and swear that you'll find a... Put your hand where? Swear on my circumcision. Now, there's nothing erotic about this story, honestly, and I'm not trying to be crude or offensive. In that culture, the circumcision was the announcement that I belong to God. So she said to him, if you belong to God, then there's an obligation to me. Now, to show you that there's nothing erotic, Boaz wakes up. He's got a terrible draft. Boaz wakes up, and he immediately says, there's a male relative closer than you. Tomorrow we'll go settle this at the city gate. But I tell you what, let's get out of here lest somebody get the wrong idea. There's nothing unsavory, sexual, purient going on at all. And Boaz knows it, but he's not sure what anyone else will think. So he says, I get your point. Notice he catches the point without having to hear a word. And then it says, and he spread the corner of his robe over Ruth. Now, what did he just say? I will obey God, and in my obedience, he will protect you through me. I'd give an awful lot to go back and re-propose to my wife. I take a risk now that she knows, but I do it on our anniversary. If I can, I will find a time and a place to take my talit and to come and to say to her, I am going to do everything in my power to obey God as your husband. And in my obedience as a godly husband, may he protect you. Come on, ladies. Is that a little bit romantic? Seriously, and that's why people say Ruth is a love story. No, it isn't. Uh-uh. It's an obedience story. The whole book is about an outsider, an outcast woman, who calls a Jewish man to obedience, and because of his relationship with God, who obeys God totally, and out of that obedience comes love. Now, let's continue on. Time went on. Jews wore tassels. I could find a couple of other examples. Then came the prophet Malachi. And Malachi said, when Messiah comes, the Son of Righteousness, he calls him, he will have healing in his corners. Ah! So Messiah will obey God perfectly. And because of his perfect obedience, God will grant him the power to heal. So they believed. So there was a woman who had been bleeding for 12 years. Now that's terrible, if you can even imagine. But worse for them than it would be for us, because in that culture, that made her untouchable. To her husband, if she had one, children, if she had them, mother, dad, stranger. Imagine if for 12 years, anytime you came, they'd say, hello, good to see you, but please don't touch me. She hears that Jesus, the healer, is coming. She thinks, if I could just touch the... Now, your English says hem. Let me show you. In Greek, the word behind hem is kraspedon. It can mean hem, edge, corner, or even tassel. If we look at the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Jewish Bible that was there in Jesus' day, in the book of Numbers, kraspedon is the word used to describe the corner on which the tassels are sewn. She thought, I think, if I could just grab his tassel, I would be healed. Now, what does that tell you about this woman? She believed, strong faith. What if she had grabbed his belt buckle? She'd have died bleeding. What if she'd have grabbed his pocket? Wouldn't have done her much good. What does it tell you about this woman? She knew the text. Maybe that verse meant a great deal because she was a sufferer. She knew if that was Messiah, which she was convinced it was, that she had a grab. Now that was, what if she had never read Malachi? By the way, there's an interesting point there to show you the individuality that God allowed the authors to have. Mark mentions she spent all of her money on doctors. Luke the doctor leaves that detail out of his... I always get a kick out of that. Luke doesn't mention she's... Anyway, so she comes up. Now, she risked a lot, even stoning, if it had been in the temple. I don't think it was. I think it's in Capernaum. But she risked a lot to hide somehow, anonymously, and to reach through the crowd and grab Jesus' tassel. And instantly, she was better. Now, Jesus sensed power had gone out of him. So he turned around and said, who touched me? Now, you can take that two ways. If you say he's operating in his divine nature, then of course he knows. He's just playing a game, in a good sense a game, to get her to speak up. If you see him in his human nature, he's not allowing himself to know. So he honestly turned around and said, excuse me, who grabbed my tassel? I take the latter, but I wouldn't argue over it. I happen to think he used his human nature often. But what does it tell you, that story, about Jesus? What do you now know about Jesus? powerful. Thank you. He wore tassels. How many pieces of art depicting Jesus have you ever observed that show him wearing tassels? Every piece of art that shows Jesus without tassels portrays him sinning. Because God said, wear tassels. My point, if Jesus, the sinless Messiah, Son of God, carried it so far as to wear the thing that reminds you not to sin, how much more should the text mean passionate devotion for me, the sinner? I think that's huge to me. If he would carry it to that extreme, the very reason they had this, he doesn't need, because he is sinless. But he still does it. I would argue Jesus lived the text. Oops. Did Jesus teach the text? Well, of course. So let's look at a couple of examples. Oi. Oh, you know what somebody asked? This is a good place to... Somebody said, what's a nudnik? I use the word a lot because that's a common word. I think Jesus used it. Honestly, it's a pure Hebrew word. It's a beautiful word. It's one of those words when you hear, it means the same thing as it sounds like. The place Jesus used it is, there was a foolish man who built his house on the sand. Nudnik is the classic Hebrew word that in English is translated foolish. But it really is, foolish is not, there's a word in Dutch, benauwd. How many of you know benauwd? Benauwd you cannot define for people. I can't tell you. But when you're there, you know exactly what it is. It's being in a locker room where it's smells and the air is moist and this is benauwd. You just see, can't define it. Benauwd. Every language has them. Nudnik is somebody that no matter how smart they try to be, it always turns out wrong. If you're in a cafeteria with your friends, every group of friends has one nudnik. If you're in a cafeteria, your back is turned, somebody drops their tray, you already know which friend of yours dropped their tray. It will always be the nudnik. There's a famous story about a nudnik. It's a modern story. Nudnik and mazel. You know mazel? Mazel tov? Mazel? Mazel is luck. Nudnik and mazel are walking down the road. Mazel says, boy, I'm so tired, I'm going to sit here on this yellow line. Nudnik says, mazel, mazel, don't, a truck will come. Mazel, look, this is a road, you can't sit there. It's Mazel says, there's no bugs here, it's not hot today, it's flat, I'm going to sit. And Nudnik argues with him, but he won't listen. So Nudnik says, okay, I'm going to go over here and pray and ask God. So he goes and sits in the grass off on the side. Here comes a trucker, sees Mazel in the middle of the road, swerves off, runs right over Nudnik. That's Nudnik. Also, it could be Santa Claus in the shower. Okay. I could have said Nicodemus in the shower, but that's too obvious. Okay. Did Jesus teach the text? Now, I want to spend some significant time on this. Not because I want to make you feel biblically illiterate, but because I wish you to feel biblically illiterate. What I want to show you is most Christians only scratch the surface of Jesus' teaching because they don't recognize the book out of which the teaching is coming. So let me give you a number of examples that hopefully will not discourage you, but motivate you to become more a student, not only of the Gospels, that's about discipleship, but to become a student of the book that Jesus taught from. Parables. I think we have the idea that parables are intended to confuse people. But a Jewish person would say a parable is an attempt to make a biblical teaching demand a response. If you put it in a parable, you have to do something about what you just heard. So it's not an attempt to hide the meaning. Jesus says, I teach in parables because having eyes they won't see, having ears they won't hear. In other words, they're not obeying. They're going to the feeding of the 5,000, but they're not learning faith. So I'm going to tell them in parables, because then it will demand from them a change. Anyway, let me show you the classic parable that Christians love. I think we've gotten it right, but that sometimes we don't notice as coming from the Old Testament. So we'll start with this. Little introduction. In Jesus' day, are you okay? You guys are awesome. I cannot believe this, that you can sit this long and listen nonstop, honestly. It says a lot about Idaho politeness. Man. Bless God that you would say that, but I'm not that. In Jesus' day, there are two main schools of rabbis. Okay? On this end, let's make this the traditionalists, Shammai. Love the Bible. The Shammai people said, let's keep it the way it always was. On this end, the progressives, we have to fit the times, Hillel. They love the Bible too. In between five other schools, somewhere in between. Between those two extremes, there were eight great debates. Probably more than eight, but eight at least. You know how a church could debate homosexuality, creation, worship style, women ministers? Those are our debates. Their debates were about very different kind of things. Jesus enters all eight. Seven times he takes Hillel's position or goes beyond him. Once he takes Shammai's position word for word. That's important to understand because we tend to think of Jesus as always being the first one to do anything. The first great debate, the greatest great debate, was what's the greatest commandment? Now, the reason they debated that was they felt there were times when there were commandments that you couldn't keep both of at the same time. So you always keep the greater. Jesus said, whoever breaks the least of these commandments will be least. Whoever keeps the least will be great. So he too had greater and lesser commandments. What do we mean? Well, they said, listen, let me give you an example. Does the Bible teach don't work on the Sabbath day? Does the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament. Does the Old Testament teach if your neighbor's donkey falls in a pit, pull him out? Is that work? If it isn't, I'm going to arrange a demonstration. Of course it's work. So what if the donkey falls in the pit on the Sabbath day? Now you got to decide. If you pull him out, which commandment is greater? Pull out the donkey and Sabbath is less. If you say, I can't pull them out, it's Sabbath day, you're breaking the commandment to pull them out, keeping the Sabbath day commandment, which commandment is greater? Sabbath day. That's exactly their debate. Because they always wanted to know, we obey God. Now let's try something. Mr. Hillel, what's the greatest commandment? Easy. Shema. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Amen. And the next one, Mr. Hillel, love your neighbor as yourself, Leviticus 19:18. That's the second great commandment. And then, Sabbath day. And then, kosher, clean, and so on. Mr. Shammai, which is the greatest commandment? Everybody knows. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Shema, Deuteronomy 6. Second, Sabbath day. Definitely. And then, kosher. Idolatry. Adultery. How about Leviticus 19:18, love your neighbor? That's there too, but it's down a ways. Would Hillel say Jesus could heal on the Sabbath day? Of course.
Love your neighbor is higher than Sabbath. When you hear that they were after Jesus about the Sabbath, they understand there were more of them that thought that you could than thought that you couldn't. Would Mr. Shammai allow you to heal on Sabbath day? No way. Sabbath is the second command. But notice they're coming out of Scripture. So now, a guy comes up to Jesus and says, what's the greatest commandment? Now, I wish I could show you this, but I'm not adequate as a communicator. The guy asks a dumb question. I mean, I don't know if you can even feel this, but when I read this story to Jewish colleagues, they think it's hilarious that any Jew could ask such a stupid question. It's about having Albert Einstein and getting to ask him one question and saying, which way is up? Because he asks a question that everybody agrees on. What's the greatest commandment? Love God. Love God. No one disagrees. So Jesus, with his twinkle in his eye, says to the guy, what does the Torah say? And the guy says, Shema. And Jesus says, good answer. Now, I bet you all his buddies were going, did you see what he, I can't believe it. And I'll show you that the text supports that, because the text now says, but he wanted to justify himself. So he asks question number two. Since Leviticus 19:18 in this book says, love your neighbor. Who is my neighbor? Now Jesus is going to interpret Leviticus. See, we miss that, I think. We think Jesus talked about love your neighbor as his teaching. It's his interpretation of what Leviticus 19:18 said. Does that make sense? Let's check. Let's try Mr. Shammai. Mr. Shammai, do you think we should love our neighbor? Of course, Leviticus 19:18. So who's my neighbor? What do you think? Believing Jew? Of course. An unbelieving Jew? Are they moral? Yeah. Okay, they're your neighbor. A Roman? Not a chance. Pagan? Never. You don't have to love a Roman. Mr. Hillel? You have to love your neighbor? Of course. Who's my neighbor? What do you think? Believing Jew, of course. Unbelieving Jew, of course. And the immoral Jew? Boy, I hate the immoral part, but yes. A Roman? They're in the image of God. Of course. What about a Samaritan? Samaritans aren't fully human. They've interbred. They persecuted our ancestors when they tried to build the temple. They mixed God religion with paganness. A Samaritan is not a neighbor. Now that's the debate on Leviticus 19:18. So the guy now, to justify himself, says to Jesus, okay, you said love God, I said love God, love my neighbor, and you said good. Who's my neighbor? And I think Jesus got another twinkle in his eye, because A, the kid now asked a good question. Jesus is going to level him. The Jews call this the best parable ever told. He is going to demolish this guy. The guy doesn't know it yet. He thinks he's asked a good question. Because there is a debate on who is my neighbor. So Jesus says, good question. I think he's thinking. I don't know for sure. A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. There's the road. Some of you here have walked on this road. About 16 inches wide. And that's part of Jesus' delightful sense of humor again. Guy goes down the road and gets beaten up by robbers. Not unexpected. And there he lies. Now the key there is the text says, your English NIV says, he's nearly dead. That's good. The Greek literally says, dying. That's even more important. Now, along came a
priest, a Sadducee. What does he do? Passes by where? Notice the other side. Exactly, that's what's funny. There is no other side. You can't pass on the other side on that road. That's Jesus' delightful, clever, so he passes by on the other side. Why? Who said that? What'd you say? Why not? Why would he believe that? It said. What's it? The text says, no one who serves in the house of the Lord may touch a dead or dying body, even if it's his father, his mother, his brother, his sister, or his wife. The guy obeys God. We roast this priest for doing what the text says. Don't touch! But what commandment does he make greater than love your neighbor? Kosher. He says being clean is more important than love your neighbor. Would Jesus agree? Wrong interpretation, Mr. Priest. Love your neighbor is the second commandment, and Jesus even says, one like unto it, just as important. So he's got the wrong interpretation. But understand, for all his callousness, he's trying to keep the text. Along comes a Levite. What does he do? Climbs over on the other side. Same deal. Why? Same reason. What commandment does he make greater? Kosher? Neighbor. Is he right? Now, in the parables where priest and Levite are mentioned, and there are hundreds of those on record other than Jesus, the third character is always a Pharisee. And I think this kid is thinking, cool, I got a Sadducee and a priest and a Levite to look wrong. Now I've got Jesus. He's a Hillel, we know that, because the kid has already said, love God, love your neighbor are the two greatest commandments. So he's thinking, if Jesus agrees with me, and it's a Hillel Pharisee, he'll help the guy. If Jesus is Shammai, he won't help the guy when that Pharisee comes because kosher is higher than love your neighbor. Does that make sense? See, we all assume when you walked in here today, if I told you, what if a Pharisee came by the beaten up guy in the parable of the Good Samaritan, you would have said, Pharisee, he'd have kicked the guy twice and rolled him off to make sure he was dead. Because you all think of Pharisees as such scumbags. There were scumbags among them. Jesus takes them on constantly. But if you were Hillel, you would have demanded that you stop to help. Because love your neighbor is the second commandment. But Jesus doesn't. How does he lay this guy out? I bet he did it with a twinkle. We'll ask him. And then he says, along came a Samaritan. And the guy's going, oh my goodness, no, I'm going to look like a total nudnik. Now, first of all, it's not quite as arbitrary as it seems. Want to see something amazing? Did you know it had happened before? In the Bible? The moment Jesus said Samaritan, they knew exactly what was going to happen if they knew their Bible. Ahaz was a bad king of Judah. So, God punished him. King of Israel, Pekah, took his army, fought against him, inflicted 120,000 casualties,
and took captives and plunder from Judah back to his capital of Samaria. Ah, the Samaritans. A prophet named Oded showed up and said, what are you doing? God didn't want you to plunder them. He wanted you to punish them. What gave you the right? He's going to be furious with you. Make it right, you Samaritans, to your Judah brothers and sisters. Make it right. Send your fellow countrymen back before God destroys you. So look what these Samaritans do. They took the prisoners. They gave them clothes. They put salve on them and put them on their donkeys and took them to Jericho. That's exactly what the Samaritan does in the parable. He puts clothes on him, puts salve on his wounds, puts him on his own donkey, and sends him on down the road to the inn. The road leads to Jericho. Now, come on. How many Christians would know that the parable of the Good Samaritan draws on the book of 2 Chronicles? It's his book! But look what Jesus does. Well, he says, along came a Samaritan. And the guy's going, oh, don't do this, please. Don't do this to me. Looking for a mouse hole. And Jesus says the Samaritan does what's in the Old Testament. He touches him. He puts clothes on him. He puts salve on his wounds. He lifts him. Touch, 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 touch. He puts him on his donkey. And he sends him on to the inn. What's the Samaritan's Bible? The Torah. What commandment did that Samaritan make greater than kosher? Love your neighbor. But now watch Jesus. So Jesus turns to the guy and he says, well, you ask me, Leviticus 19, who is my neighbor? Who was the neighbor in the story? The guy can't even answer. He says, the one who helped him. Excuse me? The one who helped him. Jesus looked at him and said, then you go love your neighbor. Who's your neighbor? Your worst nightmare. Jesus turned the subhuman, the homosexual, the drug abuser, the serial rapist, your worst nightmare. Jesus just turned into your neighbor. And this kid's going, I have to stand in front of all my friends and admit that I have to love a Samaritan. People, the first and foremost meaning of that parable is not about helping beaten up people. The Bible is full of it. That parable is about loving your enemy. Because Jesus makes your worst enemy the neighbor. Try something. This isn't even nice, but it's almost at the end, so I'll try it anyway. Think of the person you despise more than anyone in the whole world. Just for a moment. Don't have to look at him. Just think of who it is. They may have done something to you so terrible we shouldn't mention it in a public place. I excuse none of it. If you can't leave here and do a loving thing for that person, you missed the parable. You may do it through clenched teeth, but your worst enemy is your neighbor. And Jesus goes on to say, unless your righteousness is greater than the righteousness of the Pharisees, even Hillel, you can't even get into my kingdom. You won't leave here today and love your neighbor, then don't apply. This is cutting. And the way he gets this guy to admit that the Samaritan is the neighbor is just too cool. But notice what Jesus is doing. What is the basis of his teaching? His Bible. He's interpreting Deuteronomy 6, Leviticus 19, 2 Chronicles. He's just screaming text. Now, you didn't get the parable wrong if you didn't know that. But there is more to it than I would ever get. Does that make sense?